Now, for the unfortunate part of what I'm asked to talk about is our discovery of human remains. It's with great sadness that we have to report an additional 7 deceased individuals were located by our deputies and detectives today. That brings the total number of lives lost in this tragic fire to 10. We again offer our heartfelt condolences to the loved ones of the victims who have lost their lives in this devastating fire.
Butte County Sheriff Derek Bell talking about the lives lost in the town of Berry Creek. More than a dozen people are still unaccounted for. The fire began in mid-August from a lightning strike, but flared up again this week because of wind and dry conditions. Joining us now is Alexei Kossoff. He's a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, just back from Butte County. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you were in Berry Creek, which usually has about 2,000 residents. What did you see? Is there a town left?
Not much of one. It was a pretty eerie sight. I was up there yesterday, and it was almost all gone. Driving through the main route through town, there were charred trees, empty lots where nothing much was left other than crumpled metal, maybe some chimneys here and there, burned out cars, and there were downed power lines everywhere. And then every so often you'd see a house that appeared almost completely untouched by the flames. And the local church actually as well made it through. So it was a strange sight to see this town hollowed out and then just a few little pockets of things left.
Yeah. How close is this town to paradise?
I'm not sure exactly, but the fire is so large that it has impacted both communities and many others in between them. Many of the residents that I spoke to who had fled and ended up at evacuation centers in Butte County, you know, had been evacuated before from the campfire in 2018 and had, you know, remaining trauma from that and were thinking about it this year. They left, you know, as quick as possible, basically, as soon as they got the evacuation warnings this week, because they didn't want to end up in the same situation as residents in Paradise did. They were terrified of getting stuck on the road in traffic and dying. So that mm-hmm. sort of trauma is very, very real for people in this part of the state.
And what else did people in the evacuation centers tell you about how the evacuation was handled, how fast the fire grew?
Many people had been keeping a casual eye on this fire for a while. As you mentioned, it had been burning for several weeks and it just whipped up all of a sudden because of the wind. And so it took a lot of people by surprise in that way and overwhelmed everyone. And it's a very remote area. People don't have a lot of great connection to the outside world sometimes in some of these communities. And some of them didn't know that they needed to leave until a sheriff's deputy knocked on their door.
One of the victims of the fire, the first victim to be identified, 16-year-old kid named Josiah Williams. What can you tell us about him?
So I met one of his aunts in an evacuation center in Yuba City. They had all made separate plans to leave, and he had been left behind with a car to evacuate. And they don't know whether or not he ever got in that car and left, or whether he tried to flee on foot, or what happened. And they had been for several days trying to find out what happened to him, and his brother finally gave a DNA sample that identified the body as his. So they are now obviously devastated by that. His mother lived out in Indiana and was just coming in to be with the family. So it's obviously, you know, a hard loss. I believe that's the first person that's been identified now.
That's so tragic. And so as people evacuate, how is COVID figuring into all of this as people go to evacuation centers?
It feels much more this year like everyone is on their own, that they kind of had to fend for themselves. In years past, you might show up to an evacuation center, there'd be tents with cots to lie on. There'd be prepared meals, you know, and things like that. This year, they're trying to keep everyone separated. And so it's been a lot harder for people, especially those fleeing with pets and things like that, that are preventing them from being able to go to hotels. So now they're sort of stuck at these evacuation sites, which are very bare bones, sleeping in their cars sometimes. I spoke with people who'd spent several nights in the car, you know. Others have RVs and trailers and things like that. But, you know, they're not wealthy people. And many of them told me how difficult this was for them financially to buy, you know, to buy gas, to have to eat out every meal for several days while they're away from home, to pay for the electricity to run their RVs off generators, all kinds of things like that. So it's put a whole different kind of strain on people who are leaving, because they have to take all of these other things into consideration now with the pandemic.
And this fire was ignited in mid-August, and here we are in mid-September. Is it normal for a fire to burn for an entire month this way?
Well, many of these fires that get huge do end up burning for weeks and weeks before authorities are able to finally put them out. But what was odd about this one was that it was not a huge fire, and it was burning in sort of a remote part of Plumas National Forest for a while. It was not really on people's radar. And then all of a sudden the wind whipped up and it blew out of control. And now all of these communities are in danger. And people in Butte County are very upset about that. They feel like the U.S. Forest Service, which was in charge of dealing with that fire because it was on federal land, did not do what it needed to in putting that fire out quickly enough. And it's unfortunate because right now, with so many fires burning, everyone is strained for resources. The federal government, Cal Fire, local departments are, you know, pitching in, but the whole West Coast is burning up, and the kind of mutual aid system that would normally reinforce our ability to fight these fires is under strain as well. So yeah, this may have been a fire that should have been out and, you know, got away from the U.S. Forest Service. It's hard to say at this point, but I'm sure there will be more investigations about that in the future.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today and sharing your reporting. Appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
Alexei Kossoff, San Francisco Chronicle reporter. Well, as the entire West Coast burns, the U.S. death toll from COVID approaches 200,000, and an upcoming presidential election lays bare our ugliest partisan divides, everything feels really overwhelming right now. We're also exactly 6 months into this. March 11th was the day everything changed. The World Health Organization declared a pandemic. The NBA shut down. Tom Hanks tested positive. It's also a somber anniversary. The 9/11 attacks took place 19 years ago today. So we wanted to check in with someone who has been a calming and reassuring presence for us throughout these and other crises. Rabbi Steve Leder is the senior rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple and author of the book More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Well, when we last spoke, it was in March, on March 27th, so about half a
yes.
year.
Yep.
How have you been doing in this past 6 months?
Like most, I have my moments of despair and occasionally drift into catastrophizing the future and have to work hard at pulling myself out of that. But I also have to say that if you had asked me 6 months ago, would I have experienced the growth spurt that I have experienced both spiritually, technologically, relationally? This pandemic has forced me, and I hope many of us, to stretch our capacities for adaptation, for leadership, for empathy, far beyond anything I could have imagined before this thing began. So there is an upside to the downside. And I try very hard to remind myself of that daily, and particularly when I kind of, as I said, drift toward catastrophizing the future.
Wow. So really a positive look at this. Tell me in specifics, if you could give me a specific of how you have grown spiritually.
This might sound odd coming from a rabbi, but I have fallen in love again with the wisdom of the sages of the Talmud and the Torah. They knew a good deal more than we about living through perilous and uncertain times. And I find myself going back again and again and again to the writing and thinking and teaching of a group of scholars and sages who frankly lived during a time when life was always precarious and uncertain, when they had no reason not to expect that they would die from some strange frightening disease or flood or fire or murder, robbery, thuggery. These were ordinary daily occurrences in the lives of people who lived 2,000 years ago, and they developed an entire belief system to manage their lives and find meaning within all of it. And so for me, spiritually, it's been a kind of re-embracing of that wisdom. Also spiritually, again, might sound strange coming from a rabbi, but the pandemic has given me time to pray and meditate and think in ways I could not during the hurry and the scurry and the worry of my previous life.
Yeah. So you've had to slow down and really focus and focus inwardly.
Yes.
What are some of the things that the sages have said that you have found particularly relevant for today?
Well, there are a lot of them. First of all, there's so much conversation about darkness as metaphor. You know, let's take, for example, the Psalm, 23rd Psalm, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of darkness, I shall fear no evil." Two things have occurred to me about that verse. The first is the poet telling us we walk through this valley. We don't stay in it forever. That all things pass, and this too shall pass. And as trite and cliche as that sounds, I find it very comforting. The second thing about that metaphor is if you think about a shadow, no matter how long, no matter how dark, Madeline, a shadow is proof of the light. You cannot have a shadow unless the light is still shining. It may be obstructed, in this case, by a pandemic, but it still shines. It may be obstructed by our grief, by our feelings of loss, by our feelings of deprivation. But these feelings are really proof of our love of life and the light that still exists. So in that sense, very, very comforting to me. In another sense, you know that the High Holy Days are coming for Jews, and we recite this prayer, which is a kind of litany of terrible things that could happen to us and how we are supposed to respond and live during perilous times. And that prayer ends with three remedies to living through times like this. The first is to really double down on our relationships with the people who matter. The second, tend to our spiritual lives, tend to self-care. And the third is to serve others. These are the ways we live through, walk through this valley of the shadow of darkness and come back out into the light.
How are you sharing this wisdom now that we are all in our separate living quarters? How do people come together? Because part of being in a spiritual community or any community is being with other people. So how are you negotiating that?
Well, I'm communicating every week with what I'm calling my Shabbat message, my Sabbath message, which I send out every Friday afternoon. And I'm about to write my 26th, which is an indication of exactly how long this pandemic has been going on. I started writing it when I thought stay at home and stay at home for 2 weeks. I said, I'll write a couple of articles for the congregation. Well, now I'm writing the 26th this afternoon. So I send out an article, really a sermon, a sermonette, every Friday afternoon. We are doing worship services online every Friday evening, every Saturday morning, every Saturday night, and people are getting used to it. And in some ways, although we miss the energy of being with other people, it has enabled people who would not get into traffic on a Friday afternoon to come to the synagogue, the ability to participate and connect and be moved by these insights and this wisdom from our tradition. So in some way, the pandemic has created greater access, not less. And, you know, we all have to make a decision, Madeline. We either focus on the piece that's missing or we focus on the beauty that remains. And I am very much encouraging people to stay focused as much as possible on the beauty that remains. Think about a sculpture for a moment. A marble sculpture began as a block of marble, and the beauty of the sculpture was always within that block of marble, but it wasn't revealed until the sculptor removed things, took things away. I see the pandemic that way. It has removed, taken things away from us. And I'm not for a moment trying to dismiss the pain and suffering, but at the same time, when we remove certain things from our lives, it leaves some very beautiful things behind, and it creates the room, the vacuum for beautiful things to emerge. And so I am urging everyone to focus on the beauty that has been created by the ceasing to create, by what we can no longer do. Now that I'm no longer running around on the 10 and the 405 all day, I have more time to write, to think, to meditate, to pray, to walk. I'm discovering beauty in my neighborhood I never knew existed. I'm meeting neighbors whose names I never knew and frankly avoided before the pandemic. I'm spending more time with my wife and children and more time with myself in a good way. And the other thing that's so important, Madeline, that I'm talking to people about is hope. You know, we can live without many things. We can live without going to the restaurant, going to the movies, getting our hair cut, getting on airplanes. We cannot live without hope. This is going to end. The bottom is not falling out of the world. And that is so important to embrace. You know, we always say life is short, but it really isn't true. Life is long. And our lives are long enough for us to get past this and to grow from it and to create more beautiful lives going forward because of the lessons we are learning through this pandemic. And I'll just share one other thought with you, which a friend of mine who had cancer three times, three different cancers, shared with me. I asked him, what did you learn in the first two cancers that will help you in this third cancer? And he said, well, one of the things that cancer taught me is that time flies even when you're not having fun. And if you or I mean, can you believe that it's been 6 months since we spoke in March about this pandemic? Can you believe that? It's staggering to me. Time flies even when you're not having fun. We're going to get through this. We're going to be okay. And in some ways, we're going to be better than we were before. Not in all ways. And again, don't misunderstand me. In no way am I saying that the lessons we're going to learn and the changes we are making are worth the suffering. I am merely saying they are not worthless. Let's make something of this. Let's not come out of this empty-handed.
It is always a balm speaking with you and hearing your words. Thank you for coming on the show today.
It's my honor, truly, and I appreciate everything you're doing to help all of us through this.
Oh, thank you. That's Rabbi Steve Leder, Senior Rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple and author of the book More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Coming up, the people barely hanging on financially, how a hair salon owner is trying to stay afloat. Our conversation next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Governor Newsom says salons and barber shops can reopen for indoor services, even here in Los Angeles, which is a high-risk county, but they can only open at 25% capacity. Rosie Ibarra owns Social Salon Suites in Glendale, and we talked to her originally back in July when she wasn't able to get a PPP loan. Well, she is still in business, and she's here to talk about what's next. Welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Melon.
So are you happy? Must be exhaling a huge sigh of relief that you can reopen.
Well, yes, and maybe not as huge as most people would expect. But yes, I am happy that part of our business hasn't opened.
Right. So you can't open the whole thing. And what does that mean in terms of clients? How many clients walk into your salon every day?
It fluctuates. So since we only have about 45% of our salons opened right now, it all depends on their own clientele base and who's coming in. But for the most part, those who are open, our hairdressers and our barbershops, they are very happy to be back to work. And the clients that have been very patiently waiting for them are finally coming in.
Oh, well, that's good. And just to explain for people who are a little confused, your business, actually, you rent out spaces to other hairdressers and like nail technicians and people like that, right?
Correct. So we have, it's a social salon suite. It's a salon suite company where we rent out individual salon suite spaces to beauty professionals. About 45% of our tenancy is a hair salon or a barbershop, but still 55% is skincare or nail services. So those are still not able to work indoors.
Well, what do you think? Do you think that it is more dangerous in terms of possibly spreading COVID to have, you know, nail services and skincare services? I mean, that's somebody actually touching hands and putting hands on faces. Is that more risky than getting a haircut?
I can see how people can maybe perceive that as a higher risk, but in all actuality, like hairdressers, when we're doing shampoos, I'm wearing a mask, or the service provider is wearing a mask, and then the client is also wearing a mask at the shampoo bowl, as what is required by the guidelines that were given from the health department and from state board. So being face-to-face really is probably the closest you can get to truly getting any kind of cross-contamination, I would say. But when you're getting your nails done, they are regulated to have some kind of a shield in addition to a mask. So, I mean, we're talking about what we already normally experience when we go to, you know, the grocery store or, you know, pretty much anywhere where there's somebody that's going to be face to face with you, there's going to be a plastic shield of some sort. And in nail salons that I've seen in other states that are already operating and not having any issues at all operating indoors, they've got the shields, they've got the masks, and we're not hearing anything that's coming from those states with those nail salons being open. So No, I don't believe that it's going to be any more risk than getting your hair done.
Can you describe how it works now and how it works differently than pre-COVID times? Like, let's say I want to come in to your salon and get a haircut. What happens?
Mm-hmm. I would have you text me, let me know when you get to the parking lot. I will text you to let you know as soon as, you know, I'm ready to greet you at the door. You walk in, you make sure that you have a mask on, and then I have a temperature gun at the front door. Take your temperature. We have a hands-free hand sanitizer dispenser. And then on the walk, I ask a few questions regarding whether or not you've been exposed to anyone with COVID, you know, if you have felt any symptoms, basically all of the questions that are required for from the guidelines. And then once walking in, I make sure that we actually have a little portable UV light sanitizing little station where you can put your phone in there while you're getting your consultation, so that your personal items can get sanitized at the same time. And we ask that you keep your mask on during the entire service. I myself will have a mask on the entire time from when I greet you. Certain people may feel a little more comfortable if I put an actual shield in addition to my mask. And I have a variety of shields. They all depend on whether they're shielded from the neck up or from the forehead down. So it all just kind of depends on what I'm comfortable with at that moment. And the same thing with my customer, because it gets it's actually quite uncomfortable as an operator to have all that gear on. But, you know, you do what you need to do. Everything has been wiped down with a disinfectant. And then we also have a portable UV light wand that we like to pass over certain surfaces that will get damaged if we did spray any kind of disinfectant on there. I mean, it's pretty clinical, I would say, in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it sounds very rigorous, very thorough. It's also the length of time, right? So it used to be, at least when you get a whole, you know, haircut and color, that's a couple hours. Is it still that long? Or do you make things happen more quickly?
It's got to be a little bit longer. Yeah, it's going to have to be a little bit longer. So I always account for an additional half an hour to all of my services, and especially like my color services. But for haircuts, probably like an extra, that's about like 20 minutes or so. And that gives us enough time to clean in between clients. But then also for color, I mean, there's just so much more, so many things that I touch, right? So which requires me to sanitize even more things in between.
Okay, so as it is now, though, less than half of your business is open or has reopened.
Correct.
And so
correct.
How are you making it financially?
Well, it is barely covering the rent and expenses. I mean, I'm not taking any kind of an income whatsoever. Therefore, I've actually, during this time, I've opened up doing hair myself just so that I can make ends meet for my family. And whatever income that we're getting for the rent of the salon professionals that can open, that's going straight into rent.
And you weren't able to get a PPP loan, as we discussed last time, or any help at all from the government?
We were able to get a loan that we have to pay back at a low interest rate, but it is not forgivable.
Ah. What do you foresee happening kind of medium to long term in your industry?
Well, I know for a fact that there has been such a close look at how we interact with our customers. You know, I do hope that with everything that has gone down within these, you know, 6 months, now going into 7 months, that the state officials for our state board, that they really truly see what has worked and what hasn't worked and really get an understanding of our industry current situation. And they can even, you know, acquire more inspection for people to make sure that they maintain that high standard of professionalism and safety. But I definitely wholeheartedly believe that we all need to be open, because the ramifications of staying closed, I mean, I'm seeing salons close by the droves, and it's just disheartening. I could have been one of them.
Rosie Ibarra is the owner of Social Salon Suites in Glendale. Rosie, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Coming up, a linking of arms on the football field in honor of Black Lives.
I don't give the NFL that much credit, because they should have done this 4 years ago when Colin Kaepernick was kneeling and acknowledged it then.
Randy Sklar is here with sports analysis next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Even though the apocalypse feels like it's unfolding just outside our doors, at least we have sports.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
The NFL is back. Last season Super Bowl champs, the Kansas City Chiefs, took on the Houston Texans last night. Around 17,000 socially distanced fans were allowed into the stadium, a stadium that holds more than 76,000. Alicia Keys sang Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Black National Anthem.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring.
And then many fans booed when both teams came out of the locker rooms together and locked arms in solidarity. We're going to talk about that and the NBA with one half of the Sklar brothers, Randy Sklar. Hi, Randy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So why did they boo these fans?
Because they're awful human beings. That's why. No, I mean, that's the way it looks to everyone else who cares about these issues. You know, they're locking arms, and it's a very strong moment of solidarity, Black players and white players locking arms while messages on the scoreboard of we must stop police brutality, Black Lives Matter, you know, signs of social justice where our country in many ways on the streets of our country where we're evolving. And you've got people in the stands, the 17,000 fans booing that, kind of in a protest of that, saying essentially shut up and dribble, even though it's football. But it's like, that to me, it's an ugly moment. Yeah. Because when you think about how the NBA is handling it, and even how Major League Baseball was handling it, there were just beautiful moments of, hey, we need to acknowledge where this country is going. And as sports, yes, we're here and we are a distraction from things, but we can't live in a virtual bubble, even though we're bubbling up somewhat like the NBA is. We need to acknowledge the fact that we have Black players, we have Black fans, we have people who want social change. And I don't give the NFL that much credit, because they should have done this 4 years ago when Colin Kaepernick was kneeling and acknowledged it then. But look, I'll allow people to come to the party late. And so it just saddened me to hear all the boos from the fans. It was in my opinion, it was an ugly moment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, speaking of bubbles, the NFL is perhaps the least COVID-proof sport there is, right? Or football is, at least, because, well, there are tackles. It's full contact. At the end of almost every play, you've got lots of bodies piling on top of each other. So what is the NFL doing to try to prevent a COVID outbreak?
I mean, they are heavily testing all of their players all the time and making sure that when they aren't playing, they are staying only amongst they're contact tracing. I mean, I wish the country would care as much as these sports leagues are as far as contact tracing and testing and, you know, rapid testing and whatnot. So they've invested a lot of money in that. And if you do test positive for COVID, you have to sit out and you cannot participate. It's almost like they treat it almost like in terms of taking care of things like concussion protocol. They will never bring you back before your time with a concussion nowadays. Same thing with the COVID testing. So they're taking extra special care because they know that if an outbreak happens like you described, I mean, if somebody gets it and they don't catch it soon enough, everybody on the team is going to get it. And then you have to start canceling games. And then it's a gigantic mess.
Well, and then some players have decided not to play because they're afraid of it. And Damian Williams comes to mind, and he was the star of the Super Bowl, right? He ran the winning
touchdown.
Yeah. And so he said, look, my mom's sick. She's got stage 4 cancer. I don't feel that I can take this risk. And so is he guaranteed a place when he returns, or could he be out forever?
I mean, he should definitely be guaranteed a place, but I'm going to tell you a story that Maurice Jones-Drew, former UCLA running back who we worked with at the NFL Network. So Maurice Jones-Drew told us about the NFL and how it's a next man up type of a scenario there. So he was practicing the year after he rushed for 1,600 yards, which is an unbelievable total for a running back to rush. And he was in a practice and he missed a hole that he was supposed to run through. And immediately he was taken out for his backup. This is in a practice. And this is a guy who had just, you know, really lit the world on fire the year before. You'd think that he would get that credit, but no, they're already to the next person. However, I do think in this day and age, you have to commend Mr. Williams for acknowledging that there are things larger than football out there, and that's important. Now, his backup, who was a rookie from LSU, Edwards-Helaire, he had an unbelievable game, and he is the future of what this running back situation in Kansas City will be. But I think they're going to definitely – you have to honor all the players that are actually being responsible right now.
All right, let's move on to the NBA, which – is enforcing a strict bubble. What's happening with the playoffs?
So the NBA, in my opinion, has done better than any league. They're amazing. The NBA is a very nimble league. And as far as moments where they acknowledge the things that were booed in the NFL, there isn't that in the NBA. There just isn't. They are full-throated on social justice, and it's amazing. So the NBA playoffs have been incredible. They've bubbled up. They've had, you know, fantastic as far as results and far as testing. And as LA fans, the two LA teams are both up 3-1 in their series and look like they're headed for the Western Conference Finals against each other, which is the series that we all wanted to see. We've been begging for this since the beginning, since the first game of the year when the Lakers played the Clippers. And it's historic in either way, because if LeBron and the Lakers move forward, then LeBron has a chance to be the first player to win NBA championships with three separate teams. If the Clippers move forward, then Kawhi Leonard has a chance to do that very same thing. So history has a chance to be made. And with the Milwaukee Bucks in the East, the number one seed, losing and getting swept by the Miami Heat, which are playing amazing in the playoffs, I think the path to the NBA championship is – so clear right now for the Western Conference. So I really believe whoever comes out of the West, and I think it's probably going to be either the Lakers or the Clippers, has a very clear shot to win. So we may be celebrating a championship, a people-less parade, if you will, in Los Angeles.
Wow.
Someone from LA is going to win this thing.
That's exciting. That's some good news in this otherwise scary, not so good news moment.
Totally. And I have to commend the NBA. The way they've set up the bubble and the way they've set up these playoffs and sort of the tournament style, and you feel like you are so intimate with these players and you can hear everything. It's amazing. I think they've acknowledged that we're in a different situation. They've leaned into it. And these playoffs in the NBA have been so compelling.
Randy Sklar, known as one half of the Sklar Brothers, and you can check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Randy, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews. Don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Branwell. Every Friday, we invite some of our favorite film critics to drop by and review the new releases. Today is no different. Joining me today, Christy Lemire. She writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Hi, Christy.
Hello. Good to see you out there.
Good to see you. And also Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Hi, Jacqueline.
Oh, so glad to be back, ladies.
Glad to have you back. Let's start off with, speaking of ladies, I Am Woman, a biopic of Helen Reddy, the Australian singer. And she wrote that 1972 anthem. Here is a bit from the trailer.
My mother tells me I have to choose between career and marriage. I tell her we can have both.
Miss Reddy, you sing very nicely, but male groups all the rage right now. You've heard of the Beatles, right?
Did it ever occur to you men to ask women what they want to listen to?
Helen, she's tapped into something here. Remember that march in New York and how many women showed up to that? Bunch of record sales marching down the street.
All right, Jacqueline, I Am Woman became the anthem, as I said, of the women's movement in the 1970s. That song, and of course, now the movie is named after it. Is the movie as good as the song?
Well, they play the song about four times in the movie, so they're trying very hard, I think, to make that comparison. But this is a very standard biopic. I think both the critics have kind of said that it's great as far as getting a little bit of an inside look at Reddy, who's a star from the 70s, sort of pairing her song and her journey with the women's rights movement. It definitely has the feel of the film from a couple of years ago, On the Basis of Sex, with Felicity Jones, where that was sort of a retelling of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her early days before she joined the Supreme Court. And it sort of has that feel of a very sort of standard biopic.
Christy, what did you think?
So I have to preface what I'm going to say with the disclosure that I grew up with Helen Reddy's son, and I've known him my entire life, and he's a producer on the film, and he's still a good friend of mine. Having said that, I agree with Jacqueline that it's very much a standard biopic in a lot of ways. It hits a lot of the beats we've come to expect and which were parodied so beautifully in Walk Hard. Like, no music biopic can do those anymore. You just can't.
Yes.
Like, right? Yes. It's a made fun of so perfectly. So you have the montages of like the different performances as her crowds get bigger and bigger, and you see her best friend Lillian physically looking at the Billboard chart and taking her finger and like pinpointing, oh, look, there's I Am Woman. Oh, look, there's I Am Woman rising up the charts. Like all the, it's kind of clunky in some ways, but uh-huh. It's got a tenderness to it that makes it warmer and more accessible than what those tropes might suggest. But it's interesting too to watch this having watched Mrs. America on mm-hmm. FX. And you know, you have a couple of different moments here where Helen Reddy is watching Phyllis Schlafly on TV fighting against the Equal Rights Amendment. And so to see the film, to see this story from the perspective of the anthem that helped fuel that movement is an interesting perspective, but it's kind of standard, unfortunately.
All right, moving on to a similar theme. This one is called Unpregnant, and it's a film about a 17-year-old who gets pregnant, can't get an abortion without her parents' permission nearby, and so she enlists a quirky friend to help her. Here is a clip from the trailer.
So you're hiding this from your man, your best friend.
Hey, girl.
And your Jesus freak parents. And you thought, why not ask Bailey Butler to drive me hundreds of miles? Because she probably doesn't have anything to do anyway.
Kind of, yes.
You're right, I do not have anything going on.
And we both know you wouldn't do the same for me.
You made it really hard to be your friend.
I'm sorry that I couldn't be perfect for you all the time.
I needed you to be perfect.
I appreciate everything you've done for me.
All right, Christy, a buddy road trip to take an abortion? What is this about?
Well, that actually should sound a little familiar to you, because that's the exact same premise as Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which came out earlier this year, which was Eliza Hittman's like really understated, kind of quiet drama version of a 17-year-old who gets pregnant and has to go cross state lines to get an abortion. This is a comic version of that, which sounds like a weird combination of stuff. But the two actresses who star in it, Haley Lou Richardson and Barbie Ferreira, have such tremendous chemistry, and the details of their friendship feel so real and lived in that you kind of go with it. It's two different kinds of movies at once. It is this, you know, high school friends who've been estranged, who are reconnecting and going on this road trip. But it is also about the state of what it's like to be a woman in America right now, where this young woman gets pregnant, even though she used a condom, was doing all the right things about being careful, but she lives in Missouri and she has to get parental consent to get an abortion. And so it's also, you know, a powerful statement about the state that women are in currently and the danger that reproductive rights are under. It's a lot of fun. It's charming. They have great energy with each other. I had a good time watching this.
And Jacqueline, in terms of the politics, like, okay, so you've got this fun buddy movie, but also some serious politics. Do they pull that off, mixing the two?
Yes. I mean, this film has several high-powered producers involved with it, including Greg Berlanti and Eric Feig, who have done a ton of stuff both in television and in film. And so this is actually a film where I think they were very delicate with balancing the message that the film is trying to put forward and sort of the questions that it's asking about what rights women have on their own body before a certain age and the realities of women that choose to terminate pregnancies. So I think it was actually delicate. Done. There's also five writers on this, so again, it does feel like they understood that was a tightrope between the comedy and the politics. But you don't think that Thelma and Louise meets Booksmart with Knocked Up would be something you would want to see, but it is, and it's quite fun. And I really just want to give a huge shout out to Barbie Ferrer. Her character, I thought, could have gone a lot of ways that were sort of tropey and clunky, but they gave that character life. She wasn't just the less attractive friend who just sort of tags along. They really gave her her own story, and it's a kind of a nice change up from her from Euphoria, which is what a lot of folks know her from.
Okay, great. And next up is a new documentary on Peacock. It's about the week Harry Belafonte took over for Johnny Carson to host The Tonight Show for just 1 week, but really accomplished a lot in that week. And the movie is called The Sit-In. Here's a bit from the trailer.
Harry Belafonte takes an existing white institution and he turns it into something that represents his world.
There are many sides to Harry Belafonte, singer, actor, activist.
Harry had an agenda and he had the people to back it up.
That was the most revolutionary move that mainstream television could have done at the time.
Okay, Christy, you saw this one, and I must confess, I had no idea this had happened. Is this a well-kept secret, or do a lot of people know about this?
I had no idea this had happened either. I think it is a well-kept secret. And part of the weirdness with this story is that this footage isn't totally available archivally. Like back then when they would shoot late night shows, they would just tape over the same tape night after night. And so you have this incredible week of television in February of 1968, where Harry Belafonte he went out of his way to bring people of color, people who were not represented as much as they should be on television, onto late night TV, onto what is traditionally a very safe and very white medium. And so he had Martin Luther King Jr. on 2 months prior to his assassination. He had Aretha Franklin. He had Diane Carroll. He had Dionne Warwick. He also had Buffy St. Marie. He also had RFK. And it was an incredible, vibrant array of guests that he amassed that week. And Johnny Carson knew at this point in time, you know, he was not equipped to deal with the upheaval in America. He didn't have the personality to address it. And so Harry Belafonte had been a guest, enormously charismatic, extremely plugged in as an activist in America during the civil rights movement. He was the perfect person to do this. And when he hosted that week, it was the highest ratings that show had ever had. Wow. Harry Belafonte is interviewed in this film, 93 years old, incredibly lucid, charming as ever. You have people interviewed who were guests that week. Petula Clark was on that week as well. And it's really enlightening. And it's so prescient in that the kinds of political topics he was tackling that week are completely standard now for the late night talk show hosts. You know, even someone like Jimmy Fallon, who wanted to be liked and wanted to be funny, they are routinely addressing substantive matters because you mm-hmm. have to. And so, mm-hmm. you know, before there was Colbert, before there was Samantha Bee, Harry Belafonte for a week dared to shake things up with this medium. And it's really informative. It's a really cool movie.
Well, it does make you wonder if it was a really highly rated week and Harry Belafonte is so charismatic and just a fantastic performer and also, you know, plugged in, could get these guests, Martin Luther King Jr., why they didn't give him a show.
That's a great question. And they do address the fact that other people of color have had late night talk shows briefly, including Whoopi Goldberg, who was interviewed in this. It's just too safe to stick with a straight middle-aged white man, you know, that's, mm-hmm. and that's what predominantly still exists on late night TV yeah. when you look at who is hosting.
Yep. All right. Last film of the day. It's called The Broken Hearts Gallery, a rom-com. This is probably a lot different from everything we've just talked about. But anyway, here's a clip from the trailer.
Why are you getting into my car?
Lucy,
what are you doing?
Left silver Prius.
Who are you?
My name is Nick.
Do you see this tie? It's the only thing I have left from my last relationship.
Why didn't you leave it here? A nail, perfectly placed. So look at that.
It's like art in a gallery. There are broken people out there like me. People who need to let go and move on.
Welcome to the Broken Heart Gallery.
Jacqueline, what is this about?
Okay, so The Broken Hearts Gallery is a romantic comedy about a breakup. So Geraldine Viswanathan and Dakari Montgomery star in this one. And Geraldine plays a 20-something gallery assistant who gets dumped ceremoniously. And she's kind of an emotional hoarder. So she keeps mementos of all her previous relationships. And it comes to her attention after this last breakup that that's probably not a productive thing. So she kicks off to make the Broken Hearts Gallery, which gives people an opportunity to bring their mementos from their breakups in and sort of say goodbye to them, give them a chance to move on. As much as this movie makes fun of things like the minimalistic mantra of people like Marie Kondo, it definitely does talk about how letting things go can let go of emotion. And it's really kind of cute. I was very sort of disarmed by this movie. It goes exactly where you expect it to. There's no surprises about it. It's slightly long for a romantic comedy, if I'm being honest, but the two performances of Geraldine and Dakari, they're absolutely mm-hmm. amazing. Folks will recognize her from maybe Blockers or Hollow, which she starred in the independent film last year. And Dakari's from Stranger Things, but they're both great in this.
Christy?
They have tremendous chemistry, and it's really unexpected the way that they interact with each other. And that speaks to how important it was clearly for writer-director Natalie Krinsky to have a diverse cast, and that shines through in the supporting roles of, you know, her best friends who are, you know, beefed up in a way that you don't ordinarily get from supporting friends. Dacre Montgomery has not done a whole lot of films. He is best known for Stranger Things, as Jacqueline pointed out, and he's got this kind of like old-fashioned, like romantic comedy, kind of low-key, stealthy humor about him, and this great presence. And Geraldine Viswanathan is just a freaking star. She is radiant, and she's vulnerable and funny. She's got just tremendous charisma, and there's a real warmth and there's an authenticity about her. Yeah, it's totally predictable, but you know, some of the best romantic comedies are. It's not the journey. It's not the destination. Rather, it's the journey. It's how you get to them finally admitting that they love each other. So it's really sweet, and it has a great energy about it.
And maybe we can all use a little bit of that sweetness,
yes.
predictability, happy endings, the whole thing. We need some less, maybe less drama is what we need right now.
Indeed.
Christy Lemire writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Jacqueline Coley is the editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hartzinski, Angie Perrin, Rebecca Mooney, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta, our digital producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards are our technical directors. Hey, have a great weekend. Take care of yourself. Stay safe. Stay grounded. Happy. Keep it together. I'm Madeline Brad. I'll see you on Monday.